Last week we were talking some about Herod, and I got off a little bit too quickly. There's a couple of things I wanted to show you about him. Just to bring you up to date, Herod was raised by people of Edomian or Edomite ancestry, and he was from a family that had converted to Judaism a couple of generations before, and so he was fortunate enough to be raised in a well-to-do household associated with the Greek and later the Roman governments. And so he was a privileged individual, and also was versed or familiar with Jewish traditions as well. And so it really made him an ideal choice for the ruler of the area that was inhabited by Jews but ruled by Romans. And so he was, as I said, ideally, at least on paper, associated for that or prepared for that position, but really didn't work out that well. He was a social climber, more interested in politics and himself rather than the people that he supposedly served. He was not a generous ruler, even though he did build or rebuild the great Temple of Solomon. He was that was not really enough to elevate him in the sight of the Jews, even though he did do that sort of to placate them. But that was not accomplished, or didn't accomplish really what he had intended. Now, he was a great builder, probably one of the greatest of that area. He was responsible for quite a few different structures all up and down the coast, Mediterranean coast, as well as in the area of Palestine or Canaan itself. But at the end of his life, he was in such a state that he had to basically fortify himself or seclude himself in a fortress. And that picture there is what's left of it. Now, he, like I said, he was a builder, and for something, at even the foundations of it, to have survived as long as it had, sort of gives a nod to the engineering capabilities that they had back at that time. That, as you see from this picture, was a round, more or less round building that was all enclosed at the time of his reign, and it had four towers around it, and as many conquering kings found out, was basically impregnable. He underwent a number of sieges in that particular place because in the engineering of it, they developed an elaborate cistern system so that even with the sieges around them, in that area, one of the first things that would become in great demand would be water. And they had, in the excavation of this place, they have found huge storage chambers underground and this elaborate cistern system that was able to catch what rain came, and hardly any of it escaped. And so quite an engineering marvel at that day and time. On the left is an artist rendition of what that structure may have looked like, and just sort of picture that over and sitting on top of that foundation that is there. Now, he was supposedly buried there, and Josephus, the famous Jewish historian, claims to have seen his tomb. But it was not until 2007 that it was actually found. And so they're fairly sure that... I forgot to stick that picture in there. They're fairly sure they have found the sarcophagus that he was in. When they found it, it was broken, and obviously there was not anything in it. Grave robbers had already gotten into it. But anyway, that was quite an elaborate building in and of itself, and it was called Herodium. And if you were to go to Jerusalem, you would probably be able to purchase a tour of that particular place. It is just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, and is much of it is, at least from ground level down, is still there in existence. All of that above ground has been torn down, but most of the rest of it is still there. So, like I said, got a little bit ahead of myself last week and forgot to bring in those couple of points. Anybody have any questions about Herod or the Idumeans or the Edomites? Remember, we weren't just chasing rabbits. The reason I got off on that is because that was one of the kingdoms that was supposed to come from Abraham. And so that was simply a fulfillment of his prophecy. What we were actually ended on last week, we were talking about the covenants. And God had made the covenant with Abraham, and then changed his name to Abraham later. Made a covenant with him, and that covenant, as most covenants do, had two sides. Whenever we borrow money from the bank or some finance company or something like that, legally that's called a covenant. And it is that the bank says, I will give you this much money if you will pay me back on such and such a day and such amount. And then you say, okay, I'll do that. And if I don't, then you get whatever it is that you're trying to finance. And that's basically the same kind of covenant that God made originally with Adam in the very beginning of Genesis. God told Adam that you will have this place to live, and it has everything that you need. Anything that you would want is there. He started off with just Adam. He found out that the garden didn't supply all of Adam's needs. So God created what Adam needed, and that was a mate. And so he created Eve, and that again was to fulfill all of the needs that Adam might have. And the problem was that there was a kicker. Adam and Eve could live in this beautiful place with no particular responsibilities as long as they did what they were supposed to do, and that was to care for it. I'm not real sure what kind of duties they would have had there, but they were to tend the garden, whatever that entailed. And in return, God told them that they could live there basically forever. And the only stipulation was, and there again, here's the clause or the kicker, is that you can't eat of the tree of knowledge. You know, you can eat of the tree of life, and that was for them to eat of. And I'm sure that if they had left that tree of knowledge alone, they would still be over there to this day eating from the tree of life, because that's what it was immortality was the result of eating from that tree. So of course that they didn't fulfill their end of the bargain. So God said, okay, you broke the covenant, then the agreement is not in effect anymore, you get out. Same kind of thing that we might have in a mortgage kind of situation. You don't fulfill your part of the covenant, you've got to get out. And so later on, he made a covenant with Noah. And I think that really that's where we ended last week in Noah, in Genesis chapter 9, where Noah was told that everything was given for you to eat, and the only thing is you can't eat it with the blood in it. And so you have already had the plants, so God added animals to that. I think if you go back, and this, you know, this would be a whole study in and of itself, but if you go back and really read the first 18 or 20 verses of Genesis chapter 9, you would find that one thing God talks about, capital punishment, but I think we could take that even a little bit further and lump abortion into that as well, as being something that God forbids, and that's the shedding of innocent blood. If an individual that's grown up is murdered, then it was blood for blood. So what's the difference in a grown-up individual and a little individual other than size? And so I think the same principle there would apply to murder of an adult as it would be murder of a child, especially an innocent child. The covenant that God made with Abram was that Abraham would have a covenant relationship with God, and again, based upon his obedience. He had certain things that he had to follow. And God said, I'm going to give you a sign. Just like Noah. Noah was given a sign, and that sign was the rainbow. And every time we see that rainbow in the sky, we know what that promise or that covenant was. But when Abram was when God made the covenant with Abram, he was given the sign of circumcision. Now, why that was chosen, I don't really know. There probably is some reason for that particular act. The other things, and I put a few up on the board here. Some of the other things that would sort of fall under that umbrella are things that God had commanded that, especially back at that time, those folks would not have understood why. Even if he had told them why, they probably wouldn't have understood it. And today, even though we have a much better scientific knowledge than they did back at that time, there's still some of the things that we don't really know why God chose that particular thing to represent whatever he wanted it to represent or to remind us of whatever. And just thinking in the law of Moses, Many of these things are mentioned, and the children of Israel were told to abstain from one thing or another, or you can eat this and you can't eat that. And we don't really know all of the reasons why. We are learning more and more. For instance, one of the things that the Israelites were commanded not to do was to touch any kind of dead body, and they would be impure for a period of time. And we understand the concept of disease and contamination and infection and things like that now. They probably would not have understood it then. The germ theory, as we know it, was not really even seriously considered until the 1860s. Now, a fellow by the name of Louis Pasteur, that I'm sure most all of you have heard of him, he finally, I think the year was 1869, he finally proved the existence of microbes and the transmission of disease and that kind of thing. And up until that time, there was just all sorts of crazy superstitions of how you got certain diseases or certain conditions and that kind of thing. One of the biggest killers in the old world, I guess would say, was what they referred to as childbed fever. And many times this was due to unsanitary conditions at the birth of a child. And one of the things that always puzzles folks, or seems to, is why are mothers that have just been delivered of a child considered unclean? Now, the scriptures say that, for a period of time, from 1 to 2 months, a mother is considered unclean. Well, one of the reasons for that is that, remember that I told you that just a second ago, that if somebody touched a dead person, they were considered unclean. And so they had to go through some different washes. They had to wash their clothes. In some cases, they had to burn their clothes. All of this is enumerated, in, particularly in Leviticus, and some in Numbers, and some also in Deuteronomy, if you want to go back and do a major study of that, which, you know, would be very worthwhile, actually. Well, this this would have been something that would have benefited the mother as well as the child, as to a little bit extra layer of cleanliness. And so they were required to be a little cleaner than usual. The circumcision, they were commanded to circumcise the boys on the 8th day of their life. Well, it was somewhere in the early 1900s that it was discovered that at about that time, at just over a week old, we have about 110% of our blood clotting factors, which means that that's one the point in time where we have the most, the material is called prothrombin and also vitamin K. We have the highest concentrations of those in our systems at that age. And both of them would help in the clotting process and all of that that goes along with it. We also know now that we did not know back when it was instigated that there are a number of viruses, particularly the papilloma virus that you may have heard of before, that is associated with circumcision or not circumcised and that kind of thing. So anyway, the whole point, you see some other things up there, bacteria and quarantine. One of the things that comes to mind is leprosy. A leper's house was supposed to be burned or torn down, and the house is called Leprous. And it was not until actually the 1930s that a doctor by the name of Hansen, and that's why it's called Hansen's disease now instead of leprosy, but he discovered that the bacteria that causes leprosy can actually live on various surfaces for up to 3 weeks. And that is how it's transmitted. And so we know it is contagious, but not as contagious or not in the same way that a common cold or measles or something like that. And that was one reason why they knew so little about leprosy. But anyway, there were precautions that people had to take. You know about them hollering unclean, unclean, that kind of thing, that they had to take back during the biblical times, that they didn't understand why. They just knew they had to do it. Well, that again is part of God's plan. We bring that on down to today, and in the church, there may be things that we are commanded to do or not to do, and we may not understand why. And that's where a lot of people go wrong, is putting too much emphasis on what they think or what they feel instead of what the scriptures say. Now, we can disagree on some things in the scriptures, and as far as what God told us to do and not to do and that kind of thing, there's really not much play there. That it doesn't matter whether we understand why God said to do it a certain way. It's not really our place to question one way or the other. Okay, that's probably enough about that. Let's go on to verses 17 and 18, or I'm sorry, 14 and 15. God is changing Abram's and Sarah's names. No more will Abram be called Abram, but he'll be Abraham from here on. Sarai will be Sarah from here on. Sarai meaning princess or my lady. Sarah meaning mother of nations. And so both of their names are changed to indicate this covenant that that God has made with them. And when God told Abram this in verse 16, he said, "I will bless her," talking about Sarah, "and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her." Then Abram fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart. Notice he was not saying this to God, although I'm sure God or God's representative here would, this was God himself, it says in verse 15, that knew what Abram was thinking. But anyway, he thought he was just incredulous. He said, "Am I going to be able to father a child at my age? And is Sarah going to be able to conceive a child at her age?" And so Abram was still trying to help God out, although we know, of course, that God doesn't need any help. But he said, "Can't Ishmael be the receiver of this this blessing also. Later on, it's going to seem like Abraham doesn't really care much for Ishmael, but if you sort of read between the lines, it's fairly clear that Abraham felt rather strongly for Ishmael, and he wanted God to bless Ishmael as well, and he did. In verse 19, he says, "No, Ishmael is not the child of promise, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant with his descendants after him." So it was Ishmael was the was a son of Abraham, but he was not the son of promise. He was the, for lack of a better term, he was the son of the flesh, and not of the promise. We mentioned before about the Sarah and her ability to have a child at this point in time. They were still, during Abraham's time, living a little longer than normal, or than we do. I won't say normal because I don't really know what normal was back then. They were living longer than we do. Their lifespan was more in the 100-year range as opposed to the 70 or 80-year range. So what she, her physical condition and all that kind of stuff, I don't know. We do know from Genesis chapter 12 that she was so attractive that Pharaoh would have taken her as a wife. And so at that time she was about 65 years old. So I don't know exactly what that says. We haven't gotten there yet, but in chapter 20 we're going to have basically the same kind of thing happening again, where she is taken or wished to be taken by Abimelech as a wife as well. And at that time, she had, of course, been 90 years old or more. So I'm not sure. She must have been a beautiful woman. We know that. And we all have, I'm sure, used the term aging gracefully, especially when we look in the mirror in the mornings and look at ourselves. But we've all used that term, I'm sure, whether about ourselves or somebody else, that they've aged gracefully. I've known a few folks that I thought actually looked better as they got older than they may have as a youngster. But anyway, up until that time, they had not had a child. But no matter what the circumstances, God said that your son is going to be, or your son of promise is going to be from Sarah. And so in verse 23, to seal the covenant, Abraham took Ishmael and everybody else in his household. And that included servants. It included those that had been born in his household, those that had been purchased, and apparently those that were simply wage earners. And any male in his household was circumcised. And even in verse 24, Abraham, when he was 99 years old, was circumcised. Since Ishmael was Abraham's son and he was circumcised, the Islamic faith also practices circumcision. This they're a little bit more lax, I guess is the term, laid back, maybe a better term. than the Jews. They don't have a particular point in time where they do the circumcision, where the Jews did it on the eighth day after birth. And so there's a little bit of difference there, but it is still a common practice among most Arab descendants to practice circumcision on their sons. Okay, any question about chapter 18? Okay, in chapter 18, coming up next, the Lord appears to Abram again, and in the area of Mamre where he lived, in this map, Mamre is right over here on the western side of Jordan, Jerusalem right up there. Then the cities that we've already talked about that were involved in the war with the four northern kings up here are right down here in this area, generally east of Jordan. And Sodom is here, Gomorrah here, Zoar here. Those are the three cities that are going to be involved in the next couple of chapters. Now, on this map, you may notice question marks beside both Sodom and Gomorrah. Those are supposed locations. We don't know exactly where they were. There has been a lot of exploratory work done in that part of the world in looking for the remains. Interestingly enough, one of the things that archaeologists are using are analysis of the soil to determine sulfur content. And one of the parts of the rain of fire was the brimstone, and that's another name for sulfur. Which sulfur does burn. It burns very hot, and it has a very strong smell. Anyway, that is one of the tools that folks that are looking for these cities are using is soil analysis to determine what the locations might be. And that's why the question mark. We're not real sure. It's sort of in a general vicinity, but not specifically known. Well, then in verse 1, the Lord appeared to him, to Abraham, by the oaks of Mamre when he was sitting at his tent door in the heat of the day. This is clearly a person, in the form of a person, that God appeared to Abraham, and they are visible. They're not a ghost. It's not a vision. It's not a hallucination, a mirage, anything like that. These are three very real physical beings, and so. Abraham lifted up his eyes in verse 2, and there were three men standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from his tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth. And he said, "My Lord." Now, whether this was a recognition that this was God, or whether it was simply Abraham being subjective, which was a common practice. A little bit later, we'll see the same kind of thing happening between these men and Lot when they meet just before the destruction of these cities. Hospitality in that culture was a very, very big deal. They were judged many times by their hospitality. In the book of Ruth, one of the things that a Jew observed about another Jew was their generosity. And one of the ways they could observe that generosity was to look at the corners of their fields. And if the person was a stingy Jew, the corners of their fields would be, or the harvest would be almost up to the corners. Now, they didn't have what we would refer to as welfare back at that time. Someone who was receiving, quote, assistance had to do something for themselves. They were not just handed out goods or money or anything like that. But they were provided a way of taking care of themselves. Even though they had no money, they had no land, no particular means of support, those people who did have all of those things, their generosity was observed by the size of the corners of their fields. And if the person was a generous individual, then there would be a lot of area there, because that was under the law of Moses. They were commanded to leave the corners of the field for those who come and glean that didn't have any other means of support. And of course, that's how Ruth and Naomi supported themselves when they came back to Palestine after their period of time in Moab. So they were provided for in that respect. So this, remember, was before the law of Moses. So we would still be under the patriarchal age at this point in time. So hospitality and care for one another was still a very big deal. And we'll see that almost the same kind of thing playing out between these same visitors, or at least two of them, and Lot in the next chapter. And during this particular encounter here in chapter 18, between Abraham and the visitors, one of them stays with Abraham and talks with him, and the other two go to prepare Lot for what's about to take place in Sodom and Gomorrah. So let's put a mark here about verse 4 of chapter 18, and we'll begin there that next week. Anybody have any question or comment before we're dismissed tonight? Okay, let's have a word of prayer then and be dismissed. Heavenly Father, thank you for this beautiful day you've given us. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity of meeting here tonight and singing songs and coming in your presence in prayer and hearing your word discussed. We pray, Father, that we will all have been benefited from having been here tonight, especially, Father, for the Christian fellowship that we enjoy one with another in the middle of the week to help to sort of recharge our batteries and prepare us for the rest of the week for our next meeting on Sunday. Be with us through all the walks of life that we have ahead of us. And if you see fit to give us another day, Father, help us to live that day to your honor and glory. In Jesus' name.